I think the problem with social media and the way it was engineered, because it was engineered to help race to the bottom of your brainstem very well, most people just, they don't use it consciously. So like when I was a therapist, I would work with people on how do we consciously use, because if you can consciously use social media, it's an incredibly powerful tool.
Welcome to the podcast, where we introduce you to incredible humans who share their journeys with the mission to inspire you to harness your own inner tenacity to drive your life and career forward. And now, your host, Adam Posner.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. We're bringing the best and the brightest in the world of business, marketing, and personal growth to help you harness your inner tenacity and drive your career forward. Squad, please meet Joe Sheppy, a visionary in human psychology who wants to change the way brands and audiences connect fundamentally. He is the CEO and founder of Solston, an AI-powered platform for human-centric experiences. Joe is pioneering the use of video games for cognitive assessment, opening new possibilities for not only the gaming industry, but for mental health diagnostics and treatment. And he is armed with his experience leading UX strategy for Big Fish Games and Emron McCann. We have a lot to talk about, startups, AI. So let's get to it. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Adam. Really good to meet you.
It is fantastic. And Joe is joining us from the amazing, one of my favorite cities in the world, Berlin. Berlin, what is happening in Berlin today, this evening, this afternoon, whatever the hell time it is?
It's business. Yeah. Business as usual. Yeah. It's about four o'clock here. Farmers are on strike. So we got a lot of, tractors driving around the city in Germany in general right now. So that's kind of a major, right? Major theme. Yeah. You know, it's,
the, you never know what you're going to get in Germany.
No.
Berlin.
No. Specifically. Yeah, Berlin's a city that, you can't prepare for what it's going to do. So, You got to get there and be able to ride the wave.
Ride the wave. Joe, what is your favorite thing about living in Berlin and working in Berlin? I know you're back and forth between Minneapolis and I think you said Stockholm, right?
Yep. Yeah, so there's this quote from, I think it's somebody at Humboldt University here who said something like, Berlin is the one city in the world where you can feel the potential of the future while also seeing the tragedies of the past, because you walk around and there's still the scars and the bullet holes.
History's
from World
there.
War II, and it's there. And then you see, you know, a lot of the technology, and Berlin's interesting as a city. Like whoever controlled Berlin in Europe always was able to control most of Europe. So it's it's just an interesting place to be. But there's a pulse here. It's like a body of water. It has its own feelings, its own spirit, and it changes with, you know, obviously with war, with the world as it goes. But yeah, so I think it's a very real place to live in that sense.
I felt as a native New Yorker, out of all the cities I've traveled to in the world, I felt the closest vibe to New York City in Berlin.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, for many reasons. Yeah. And really kind of what you said before, there's a vibe to it. There's a pulse, there's a life beat to it, a heartbeat to it. And I love it, man. So let's get into it. And I like to hit the rewind button. You have a fascinating, multifaceted background. And if you don't mind me asking, may I ask what your parents did for a living?
Sure. So my mom was a flight attendant and a kindergarten teacher.
Interesting. How'd that work?
Really
not at the same time or different stages of her life,
two careers. Yeah. So her first job was a flight attendant, and then she became a kindergarten teacher.
So she has crazy stories, right? Back then.
Both from the airlines and from, you know, it's I'm like, sure. what kind of crazy do you want? Do you want 6-year-old crazy? Cause that's pretty crazy. Or, you know, airlines themselves. Yeah. Back in the day when people could, smoke and, you know, yeah, exactly. So that, and yeah, dad ran a marketing agency for 30 years about. Now he has, it's a single malt whiskey. It's called Lost Woods. It's won 3 double golds at the International Spirits Competition. So he went from a marketing agency for 30 years to whiskey.
I think I need to have your dad on the show.
You should. He's got some interesting stories. So he's been an entrepreneur his whole life, and really a lot of time in the ski industry. So he used to climb with Skip Yawell, who founded Jansport, for example. Wow. Ed Vestures, all these guys. So he was That was a part of his background. So that's part of why I grew up in the ski industry. So I think the moment I could walk, Dad was like, all right, putting him in skis.
You're definitely on skis before you could walk.
Probably weeks later. Yeah. Or like days later. Yeah.
So there's really, you know, it's almost like it was in your blood, in your DNA to follow this entrepreneurial, free spirit adventure. Like it was there and looking back on it. And that's a pretty damn cool background.
Thank you. Yeah. It's parts of it for sure.
I always like to, like, if you, where you are now in life, looking back for kind of like your early childhood memories, like, was there a couple that stood out about mom and dad? You're like, holy shit, the reason I am a lot of who I am today is because of that time, that moment, what I absorbed from them. I mean, for me, I talk about it as how I parent my kids, like what kind of dad and I am because of my mom and my dad, how I was brought up, just like the approach and the creativity and the nurturing. But both my parents are teachers, so there's not a lot of like the business side. I don't know where the hell I came from on that side, but I'm always curious to hear.
Yeah, I think it wasn't necessarily one moment as much as themes. Like, we were always really empowered to make decisions for ourselves. Like, my parents took me to like six different kindergartens and said, which one do you want to go to? Because they felt that the one that I enjoyed the most and wanted to go to the most was the one I was going to learn the best at, which research, you know, whatever, how many years later it is now, has proven that to be true. So I think that, and then just exposure to a lot of different types of experiences, that was really big in my family. So my brother and I, you know, whether it was getting a musical instrument, traveling, different sports, it was really important for them to expose us to as much as we could, and then see where we leaned and where we gravitated towards, and then empowered us around those things. So that, as well as, just, I think, nature being a very important part of their value system. And it, of course, it's one of those ones that, I think I adopted, and, as a family, it's something that we have in common that I think is really binding as well.
I love it how it's really infused. And we get to this part of your journey. You have a master's in clinical psychology. How'd you take that degree into user experience?
So it's kind of, it was almost the other way around. User experience is what compelled me to go back to school and get that degree and become a therapist. So what I did, I was working with clients in Switzerland at a Fortune 500 company. And I think one of the goals of a user experience person, a designer, a researcher.
Yeah, let's give everybody a little bit of background. And there's a fundamental difference between UI and UX, and folks have to understand that, right?
There absolutely is. user experience, it's all the...
That's the UX for everyone out there playing along.
That's all the digital experiences we use today. There's typically a UX designer and a UX researcher who really, hopefully anyway, really thought through who the audience was, whether that's creating personas, doing research on who that is, how do you create that experience. Mm-hmm. That can be used to benefit the user. It can be used to benefit the business. It can be used for both. And ultimately, the best UX people are really good at understanding what do businesses need, while also understanding what do audiences and users need, and blending those two together. While UI people are typically the ones who really understand how to put those design patterns into place. So a UX person they're like the architect, and the UI person has to then figure out how to actually make that look nice.
I'm going to clip that up for all the other recruiters out there who can't tell the difference, and they're hitting up candidates that are UX that are really UI, and they should learn that one. But the mindset of digital interaction, and maybe you could talk a little bit about like the gamification element in certain ways and how to be ethical about that, right? Like, because obviously your task with a project, or if you have a client, that there's an end objective. You want people to use the product. But at the same time, you don't want to take advantage and make it too addictive. And maybe you do. Maybe you're doing Candy Crush or Angry Birds or one of those, or whatever the games my kids are addicted to, like Roblox and Minecraft. But how do you find that balance of, yes, we want people to use it as much as possible, but we don't want to, you know, be unethical?
Yeah. Well, so first off, engagement turned into a dirty word, and it's not. Like, engagement is
Hot takes, spicy.
It's really, really important. Yeah, it's really important. So
Sorry, I just had to play with that button.
You're all good. It's there's never like, if you're in like, yeah, I'm in a really good relationship right now. It's really healthy, totally not engaging. No, that never happens in your personal relationships. You want engagement, but you want it to be healthy and sustainable. So, and that's the same thing. Like we work with most major game companies. Like we work with Rovio, who makes Angry Birds, for example. Mm-hmm. And so if you think of these games, they also don't want you addicted. When we think of really good user experiences, they're typically sustainable for the person and for the business. So you're collecting business requirements, like what do we need to achieve as a business? And what businesses don't want, like even casinos know this, they don't want you to spend a bunch of money and then never spend money again because you just spent your fortune.
There's a fine balance between taking it to the cleaners and having you back in to drop off the dry cleaning again, right? Like,
the best customer at the casino is like the 90-year-old lady.
My mom's.
Who spends like $20 once a week and meets her friends. And because then you can plan a business, then you have planable mm-hmm. revenue, you know what your costs are, as opposed to someone just dumps their life fortune. And it's, you know, I don't know, some person with hundreds of millions of dollars, if you could even spend that much at a casino, and that happens and you bring in a bunch of money. And now what do you do with it? It's like the, what were the stocks that were getting like really pumped by
the
Reddit?
Penny stocks. Like, GameStop and
yes,
not like, Blockbuster, the other one,
AMC. As a CEO, that's a huge problem to solve because now all of a sudden your stock's going through the roof. And what do you do? What do you do with that extra capital? Yeah. Or is that just going to go
vanish with the stock price drops? And,
yes.
You know,
so
it doesn't really work like that.
Yeah. And so I think on the UX side, the key goal is to understand what the business needs and then what the users actually need, both from a usage perspective, but also from a health perspective. And that's part of why I went back to school and said, I need to become a clinical therapist and need to really understand these things, because if I'm designing experiences that impact hundreds of millions of people, and I don't even know what a like button does, for example, like, people are engaged with it. But what is it actually doing? It's not sustainable for Facebook either.
It's so crazy. Yeah, let's talk. I mean, let's take a little bit of a turn here. And I love your, I've watched all the documentaries. I've watched the Netflix. I've watched, you know, the Zuckerberg movie and like the like button, like the story of the like button, how that changed everything. And these vanity metrics that have driven society absolutely insane. But they've been obviously be able to monetize on, like, the Kardashians would never be who they are. You know, like, you know, It's all numbers. It's all numbers and popularity. And in one breath, it sickens me, right? I watch my kids, you know, follow these people that I think are just jokes as human beings, you know, and other folks who follow are very talented, right? There's some very talented creators out there and they're engaging. And there's good stuff. But I want to ensure that my kids are following the right people for the right reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm not going to throw names out here and throw, you know, these influencers under the bus, but it's a slippery slope. And I'm also trying to teach my kids that those numbers don't mean everything, that you really have to evaluate people, entertainers, athletes, celebrities for who they are, not just because of their numbers. What's your hot take on likes and just vanity metrics in the world of social media?
Well, I mean, you know, what's clear, like the University of Michigan had a pretty solid study on how Facebook usage over time, for example, was causal in terms of depression. Mm-hmm. And you know, the more
comparatitis, people, right?
The more people, you know, post selfies, things like that, we've seen that's associated with depression, anxiety, things like that. I think this is nothing new. Like our species has been doing this for a long time. So like, think of when bronze was invented. For example,
I don't remember that far back, Joe.
Yeah, but you could use it for farming. You could use it for killing people and way more efficiently than sticks, for example. And so there's always a time where when we invent new technologies, we misuse them. And then we learn as a species, hey, we can make these like swords out of bronze now. Like you probably shouldn't let kids just play with them. We need a rule for that. They get locked up in this chest now that's also made out of bronze, by the way. And so, you know, what people don't realize is like social media is very new. It's like 2004, 2005. Like it's pretty darn new.
Pretty new on the timeline of depending on how long we're extrapolating this out, right?
So we're just figuring out now as a species how to use it. It's a tool.
I love being the guinea pig. Love being the guinea pig, Joe.
Yeah, that's, hey, you know, I would rather be the social media guinea pig than the societies that discovered bronze.
Yeah.
Because that was bad. Until it was good. Yeah.
Until it was good. So I want to talk about, continue.
Well, that's just it, right? It's technologies. I think as human beings, if you look at all the ape species, whether, you know, go to the zoo or go into nature and watch a gorilla, watch a chimpanzee and give them a tool. What do they do with the tool? They play with it, they experiment with it, and then they misuse it. And then after they misuse it, hopefully they don't die. And then they don't misuse it in that same way again. And I think the problem with social media and the way it was engineered, because it was engineered to help race to the bottom of your brainstem very well, most people just, they don't use it consciously. So like when I was a therapist, I would work with people on how do we consciously use, because if you can consciously use social media, it's an incredibly powerful tool.
Oh, networking, communication, all those fundamentals to use it the right way. But and a lot of us do have addictive personalities and, you know, underlying mental health issues that just get triggered by all the negative downside of social media, comparison, you know, all those things we talk about. But let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about Solston. What does the name mean?
So Solsten, or Solsten, as you might say in like Swedish, they're these Icelandic spar, these little crystals, and Nordic people use them to sail back in the day and to navigate the Atlantic when things were cloudy, when you couldn't see where to go. So they're probably what were used to get to North America. Mm. So what we do as a company is we really help other businesses navigate where they need to go. I think your job as a builder, as a founder, as a product manager, anybody at a company who's building something is to understand where audiences are going or where your customers are going and meet them there. And so we see ourselves as that Solsten for companies. And the word itself, like soul and sten, even though it's sun, but kind of shedding that light, but it has that humanness to it. If you say it in English, the soul, kind of that.
I dig it.
Sten, it's stone, it's solid. So, you know, there's a lot of trust in our data and what we do and the privacy behind what we do. So, yeah, it had multiple check marks for us. And
it's nice. It's got a ring to it. And tell us a little bit about the mission and who you work with.
So our vision is, how do you allow experiences to be architected in a way that activates the highest level of human potential possible? So, you know, what if Facebook was architected in a way where, you know, you were able to use it in a way that it benefited you as much as you possibly could benefit you? That's our vision. You know, I think the mission on a more tactical level is really empowering the most creative people in the world, the designers, the builders, the marketers, to actually really be able to understand their audience on a psychological level, which today the whole internet's a behavioral internet. And behavior shows people what people have done. It's what happened in the past. Where psychology is different is it lets us know what people will do. So if I'm building an experience, and if I'm building the next version of Facebook, and I have an idea of the psychology of my audience, I'm going to be much better equipped to understand how to build that for those human beings. And most UX designers don't get into their career because, like, ooh, I'm going to build this super addictive, terrible experience. The guy that did the like button, I don't think he was like, yeah, in 20 years from now, this is going to like fuck some people over.
It's like, shit. Is it going to be on his gravestone? Like, do you think it's just going to, look at that. See, there it is. There's some augmented reality.
Yeah, right there. No, you know, I think most people really want to do
people
right.
People liked him.
That's
what I was going to say. People liked him.
It's the tombstone, cowboy Western style tombstone. But I think most people who design and create experiences, they would love to be able to equip this with this sort of information, but they just don't have access to it. So most of our customers, like we work with like EA and Epic Games and Supercell, a lot of gaming companies. We work with also some non-gaming companies like Peloton, for example. Mm-hmm. So a lot of gaming, health, fitness. And then also there's clinical trial stuff we're doing in the background that we're working through.
But fascinating.
Yeah. It's where the most authentic behavior happens on the internet. So there's this saying in adventure psychology, which is, show me how you play and I'll tell you who you are. You really, you know, some 45-year-old guy is like a 23-year-old female orc. Like when no one's watching, that's who they chose to be.
Yeah.
So you really get a interesting sense of who the person is when they game. So that's part of why we've focused on gaming, because we're really set on what's the next level of psychology.
So you talk about, I want to unpack this, from playtime to primetime, the evolution of gamified living. What the heck does that mean, Joe?
I think if we look at where we're at today, most of the media that we consume is passive, meaning you sit in front of a TV and you watch the Netflix thing. You sit in front of Instagram and you scroll. When you look at gaming is interactive media, input, output. So if you look at a lot of health data, whether you're playing shooter games or Roblox or, there's not one study that shows, for example, that playing shooter games is bad for you. Actually, quite the opposite.
Really? Not one. Despite everything we see in the media, that they're blaming the shooter games for all the school shootings.
Yeah, not just one.
Not just mental health.
There's actually hundreds pointing the opposite direction. That it helps with cognition, it helps with school, it helps with even like depression or anger issues or things like that. So, you know, the thing is I think people, they want to point fingers, but that's a separate topic. But if you look at games and where we're going, play is how we learn as a species. It's what's foundational to who we are. When you look at really healthy historical societies, like take, for example, the ancient Hawaiians, where they had so much resource advantage that they had enough leisure time. And what did they do with the leisure time? They built surfing. They created surfing. Let's stand on a board in the ocean. You know, and let's, what are you going to do? We're going to ride the ocean. We're going to play. And what's happening today is, and I think this is where a lot of mental health challenges come from. You know, there's this quote, like, idle hands are the devil's playground. And a lot of people today have idle hands because they're in roles or situations in life where they're not building
bored,
or farming.
Under challenged. Yeah.
Yes. And
underutilized.
And they didn't grow up in an environment or a household where play was acceptable, where play was safe. And so, you know, play can be skiing, or it can be playing a video game, or playing a board game, or playing chess. There's a lot of ways to play. And if you ask, most people don't know how to play well. And so I think the future, if we look at how Netflix is like crushing it with their games now, like they're absolutely doing well, like incredibly well with that. If we look at the future, we're going to start to see play interlaced with a lot of brands that we experience. Chipotle is already talking about things like this. We actually work with some really big brands on the back end, in terms of how they actually create more play in their experiences. And play is fundamentally healthy for people. Like if you look at the outcomes of play, everything from people who don't play, whether it's video games or, you know, whether it's a sport or something, like ever the age of 30, their crystal memory tends to go up. Their fluid memory tends to go down. The second you start playing again, your fluid memory starts going back up again. So play is just fundamental to who we are.
It's fascinating. My 5-year-old son, I'm an old school Lego head. I'm a Lego master. I love Legos. Behind me in my office, I have all my adult Lego sets because I keep them away from my kids from breaking them up here. And the word Lego is play good, right? Like play well. Yeah. And that's where it comes from. I got brought up with Legos, and my parents saved all my Legos, and I've been playing with them with my daughter and now my son, who's at the age, and to watch him just fully embrace the creativity. He would choose his Legos over his iPad. When we get into Lego mode and start playing and we're down in the basement, just going to watching his brain think, the creativity, what he's making. That's for me, that's everything. Like that is everything. That like that, and watching him problem solve. And asking me, well, how does this piece work with that piece? And watch his brain work. And then it's teachable moments. Now you go for it, dude. I'm not going to show you. Like, show me how to do it. Teach me something. And now he's proud. I come home from work. He's like, look what I made. Look how I did this. You remember what you told me yesterday? And that's like, all right, I'm doing something right on the parenting front there. But we have to encourage more of that.
Yes.
Let's talk about the rise of bio psychosocial AI. What did you coin that? I mean, is that a made up word? What the hell is that?
I guess we did.
Biopsychosocial AI. Biopsychosocial. Let's say it all together, folks. Biopsychosocial.
So it's biopsychosocial.
Biopsychosocial. We're gonna phonetically have that out there because me fail English.
Yeah. So biopsychosocial. it's been around a long time in clinical psychology. So it's not a new concept. But it's something that the problem with the medical system globally, well, there's a lot of problems, but one of the major ones is it takes on average about 10 to 15 years for innovations or scientific findings to actually get implemented in medical systems. So even though like we've known scientifically speaking that taking a biopsychosocial approach in therapy or, you know, in a psychological setting where we're working with patients is the best way to go through a patient process, that doesn't mean that every psychologist you're just going to see is going to take that approach. So what it means is you're taking into account the biological aspects, the psychological aspects, and the sociological aspects of the person when you're diagnosing and treating them. For example, I had a woman, she's 65 years old, African-American lady, super sweet. One of my patients said she had really bad depression. And so we went through our diagnostics, psychological side, and yes, she fit the criteria for major depression. But bio, I said, you know, have you ever experienced anything like this in your life? She's 65 years old. And she said, no. I said, can you tell me about what's going on medically? Like, what's new? And she said, well, my rheumatoid arthritis is just acting up real bad. And, you know, in that population in the United States, there's a higher incidence of rheumatoid arthritis. And so inflammation can definitely trigger depression.
Right. So the pain, the discomfort.
If I would have just taken a psychological approach to treating her, she would have potentially ended up on like an SSRI or meds.
Instead of treating the arthritis.
And we were doing cognitive behavioral therapy and nothing would have changed. I said, how about this? Let's go back to your doc and let's really work through the arthritis stuff first. And we're not going to prescribe anything. We're going to stay here from a CBT perspective because we can work through a couple of things, but I don't think this is it. And she came back to me, called me a couple of weeks later and said, Joe, like I'm doing fine. Like I'm good. I'm happy again. Like we got my inflammation.
How is that
down.
Rocket science? How's that not rocket science? Right? Like come because on, like treat the body first and it usually cures the mind.
It's not, but the problem is the people who treat advanced diseases are highly specialized. So, you know, your general practitioner, your general psychologist, therapist, they should be taking a biopsychosocial approach with you. But most of them, when they were in school, were not taught that. So what psychologists tend to do is take a psychological approach. What MDs tend to do is take a biological approach. And then there's a sociological approach to it too. So, you know, when I practiced, I was in Utah and I had,
That was for the skiing, right?
Both. I was there. And I think that's part of it is I've always tried to engineer my life around how am I able to make it very easy to do all the major things that I really care about right now. So on the outside, it was like, wait, how is he like skiing for the North Face, has a startup and is also doing therapy and like, but all of them were interrelated. So I was an adventure-based psychotherapist and my skiing sponsorship also had levels of photography that were related to it, which that was a big part of my background. And then what I was doing was trying to figure out how I put play into experiences so that they're all synergistic as opposed to like cognitively dissonant, which that was like a super important part of that.
Gentlemen across the nation, I have an urgent message for you. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Manscaped. The brand that took your balls to space is now launching them to the ultrasphere. Introducing the Lawn Mower 5.0 Ultra. Featuring a new cutting-edge design and next-generation dual skin-safe blade heads for different shaves. It's pretty much a spaceship to take your boys downstairs to the next level. Join the 9 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with the brand new Lawn Mower 5.0 Ultra by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping when you use the code POZCAST, POZCAST. High tech for low places. That's Manscaped. And I got to tell you, since I got my hands on this pair of trimmers, my life downstairs has changed. My wife loves it, if you know what I mean. But let me tell you, this has made it so much easier to take care of what I need to do downstairs. You know what? Take it on the go. Manscaped has you covered. This puppy comes with a travel case and even a travel lock to avoid any accidental powering on or weird looks in the airport. Guys, check this out. Go to manscaped.com, get 20% off when you use the code podcast, plus free shipping. I'm telling you, your balls have been through enough. It's time to go ultra with Manscaped. Check it out. Fascinating stuff here. I literally, and my friend's going to listen to this. I'm going to introduce you to a friend of mine after the show named Michael Berman, who I think you and him will find some incredible synergies here. Cool. Something pretty cool. You say failure is not an option. It's imperative. Let's unpack that one, because I believe you, especially my journey the last, you know, 7-8 years as an entrepreneur. I had to learn how to fail, and I tried to learn how to fail fast and deal with failing and learn from it and the lessons. Like, because what happens if you're not failing? You're just doing the same shit all the time. You're not breaking shit.
If you're not failing, you're going to end up with mental health problems. Like mental health issues. When I looked at like 99% of my patients and we distill it to what's actually going on, there's some way that they're stuck. And typically it's everybody else's problem, or the system's problem, or the company's problem, or their parents' problem, or their spouse's problem. So it's like, you're stuck. And why do they not want to get unstuck? Because they're afraid of failing. And that fear is what keeps them there. And, you know, fear is one of my favorite quotes about fear is it's, you know, it's miles and miles wide, but it's less than an inch deep. And it's
this, perspective is everything.
It's this idea that there's all these things that could happen. And so really, like with failing, it's when you realize it's only, there's a such thing as failure. And failure is when you don't succeed at something, but you don't learn from it. That's true failure. As long as, and so when we actually say it's important to fail, I think we need a better word for it in the English language, because I think what
it's a polarizing word.
Yeah, because what it should actually mean, because if you think of like the old, like I like going back to, I have a degree in cultural anthropology too, so I like thinking about the past and evolutionary biology and things like that. If you look at failure from a linguistic perspective and you go back in time, it's like, if you failed to get the food for your family that night, people could die. So there was,
right. It was extreme. It was an extreme word. It was
exactly. And I think that's where some of the stigma still is packed in. It's hundreds of thousands of years of stigma. But if you look at why I think we need a new word, because if like you try to work at a new company, or you try to start a company, or you try to get that promotion and you fail, like the people that succeed the most are the ones who are able to not just fail, but fail and learn the fastest. And failure and learning together equals wisdom. And that's one thing that AI can't do. AI can't really become wise, because true wisdom is the facet of really doing things that sucked and you figured it out. And or you didn't figure it out and you learned from it. And when you learn from it, you're able to understand a very broad perspective of a thing. So that's, I think, that inherent wisdom is something that in a future society too, it's like really beneficial to have.
So let's double back on that. And let's talk about AI, because I want to get your take on it. You said something fascinating there. So you're saying that AI cannot gain wisdom. And there's a difference between learning, whether it be ALM, MLM, right? Like, yeah. And not MLM. Advanced machine learning, as the machines absorb more input from all different sources, are they not going to be able to put those two pieces together and move forward?
Yeah. So I think what AI is incredibly good at, way better than we will be at to a point, is synthesizing information. So like we're at the dawn of these kind of really big LLMs and language models that are just like taking off. And what that's going to do is allow for synthesis to happen in ways that we can't even imagine today. And so what we have to distinguish is the ability to synthesize information wisdom.
The ability to synthesize information and wisdom, where man separates from machine, the last frontier of them taking us over.
Well, is it wisdom? We have to ask ourselves, is it wisdom?
What is wisdom?
And I think some people would say, you know, maybe that is. But if you think of all the things in your life where you've really, really needed like really good advice, you needed super good advice for something. The inherent wisdom, the ability to really get to know you on a biopsychosocial level, on an emotional level, on a, you know, it typically is a person who provides that wisdom well, is somebody who can really understand you. And
the
so
application of what you've learned, right? It's yes, one thing to learn something and have the wisdom, but applying it.
And they've right? gone through similar battles or, you know, missions, and then they've learned from them. And that's why they've gained the wisdom. Like if you read like someone like Marcus Aurelius, for example, there's a lot of wisdom there. Well, the guy did a lot and he went through a lot. And the thing that AI can't do is it can't generate. And so I personally think that an aspect of wisdom is generative thinking. So AI can synthesize what was, and I think the future of humanity will be a more wisdom-based economy. So that's tied back to failing, right? Because if how do you gain wisdom if you don't fail and try things? And then how do you generate if you can't take those things and put them together? And you know, AI is really good at saying, here's everything that existed. We're going to put it all together and compile it and show you this thing. And you may have never seen that thing before. But the 5% I think that people are going to need to get really good at is the how do you use AI to synthesize things better than everyone else, so you can actually ideate and bring new things into the world better than other people.
It's an accelerator, and I tell people to use it as a tool, don't use it as a crutch. And I think that's a problem that we have, that too many people are jumping on this tech thinking it's going to replace thinking that it's going to replace their jobs when it's not. It's going to augment it, and you do it the right way.
I mean,
garbage in, garbage out also, right?
Like if you do what we do, like we're the most advanced psychology in the world for understanding human, basically, well, AI in the world for understanding human psychology. And if you look at AI's output, like AI and these LLMs, like it has what we call illusions. So if you bring in somebody who's an expert in a certain topic or subject matter, they can spot out like where the illusions are taking place. And illusions are like basically the things that, you know, when a lay person reads ChatGPT, they'll be like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But then the expert would read it and be like, wow, ChatGPT was really confident there, but that is completely wrong.
Right. Like that first use case with that attorney who presented a case, right? And he's like, that's not even a real case, moron. Right. Yeah. Don't take it as gospel.
Yep. And that's where I think, you know, what we're kind of like a beehive, like it's going to allow us to become more specialized. And I also think this, I mean, not to bring it back to mental health, but I think this is part of the challenge too, is human beings, like even 100 years ago, you had to know how to cook and farm and hunt, and you had to do all these like really empowering things, like how to build a
thing.
Yeah. And those are like, we're still that being, we're still that body. So if I am the best neuroscientist in the world for running, you know, models to diagnose a certain type of Alzheimer's, and like, I'm incredibly good at that, but I can't even start a fire. Like, so I think where we're going as a species, we're going to have to find that balance between really getting good at synthesization, specialization, and generative thinking, while making sure that the average person has a baseline of skills that let their primitive body know that, or our incredibly advanced primitive body know that we're still capable. Because that was a big theme for me with patients, was a lot of times kids and adults who had anxiety, you know, I'd be like, hey, do you know how to get food yourself? Or do you know how to start a fire? And it was like, no. There's really good research with like anorexia for teenage women showing like 2 weeks in nature, just learning how to start fires, learning how to prepare food. Like you'd see a lot of the symptoms go away after that. So this kind of the combination, I think the more AI becomes better at synthesizing, the more powerful it gets, the better we're going to have to get at being generative while also being really good at taking care of still knowing we can do the basic things.
That's amazing. Joe, what's your approach to hiring in your organization?
Wow.
I mean, based on this whole conversation, like let's level it up to 30,000 foot view. What is your philosophy and approach to building teams and hiring? Let's keep it high level here.
So it's adapted based on the growth of our company, based on the stage of the company, and based on the location of the company and how we worked. So for us, when we first started the company, we went through, we followed actually very similar to Microsoft's hiring process when they went from about 1,000 to 4,000 people. So we interview 4 people, the research, so it's very empirically based. The research showed that if you interviewed for motivations, attributes, historical skills, and achievements, those four things were basically the best predictors as Microsoft was scaling. So we have one person that would interview on each of those topics. We did that till about 20 people. And we also sent out psychological assessments. So because that's what we do as a company, we were able to identify, hey, here's an engineer that's really effective here. Does this engineer have similar attributes that we know make this engineer effective here? It doesn't mean that they would be effective or not effective at another place. And I think that's really important, is we try to treat our company as an organism. I can tell you just flat out, speaking of failure, like we messed up during COVID. Like we we all went remote and you're not doing face-to-face interviews anymore. We stopped doing psychological assessments.
Why'd you stop that part of the process? How should that be hindered by COVID?
Overhead. We were scaling during COVID remotely. We went from like 25 people to maybe 75 people, and just being founders and not having the time and space. General Catalyst, the partner there, recommended to us that we as founders interview all the way up to at least the 300th employee. I think that was really good advice.
And then you have to scale. Then really.
Yeah. But he said up till 300, your team's going to get annoyed by you guys, but it's going to be invaluable.
Core of your business. That's the engine. You know, that's the first 300 employees. I've read that as well. The first like 200-300, that's your core. And there'll be attrition and, you know, folks falling off, but.
Yeah. So I think, you know, now we've gotten back to the assessments. We've gotten back to really.
Go back to what worked.
Yeah. Where we screwed up is we hired people who were like, you know, really successful in other jobs. And they were like, you know, VPs or director type level roles, and they have really strong opinions on hiring. And we let them basically, hey, this is how you took that company to 300 million, or this is how you took that company to X. Like, and we really empowered them to do things how they saw fit. And that was a mistake. Like, I think as founders, that was a failure. And one of the things we learned is, you know, having product market fit, raising your Series A, raising your Series B, which we're past that point now. It's statistically lightning in a bottle. Like, you're more likely to hit by lightning multiple times than getting to that point from a business perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think as founders, you really are looking to get to a point where you're like, oh, finally, there's help here. There's other people who are, you know, they've done this before, and realizing like every business is really unique and it requires a unique sort of approach, and it's here for a reason. And so what were the things we did, and going back to our roots, and what were the things that we did really, really well before? And we corrected those, we learned from them, and we made changes based on it. So I think our hiring up to 20 worked phenomenally well. Most of those people are still here. Since 6 years ago is when we started this, and they're an incredibly impactful people at the company. Then we got, we tried to scale too fast, and
it's usually not kiss of death, but you know, it's a pain point, so to speak.
Yes. I don't think one company scaled well during COVID. Like,
well, the money was cheap. Everyone was remote. It was easy to just hire people. You didn't have to see them face to face. And it was a bet too. I mean, let's talk about it. Hiring is a bet. It's a gamble, right? You're betting on past predictors. You're betting on interview performance. You're betting on referrals. But until you get them into the position and owning that, you have to set these employees up for success.
Well, and that's where I think exactly. Like, you nailed it. And I think that's where the psychological assessment side of things, like, hey, we're pros at this. This is literally what we do. Let's use our own tech to do this, because psychology is one of the few things that predicts the future. So when you understand somebody's psychology, their cognition, you can get a good sense of what they're going to do. And that's where I wish we would have done those assessments through COVID. I think that's something that would have really helped us.
But you learn, and that's where the wisdom comes from, Joe.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's it.
Joe, what's keeping you up at night?
You know, I think as a founder, you have a vision for what you could create. And part of the reason why you raise capital is because you appreciate time. And, I have this idea that, well, where can we get this to in X amount of years? So we've been doing this for 6 years. And our vision is like, how do you actually have all this technology? Like if Solston was in the hands of every business, I could guarantee literally that all the tech we'd be using would be at least 1% healthier biopsychosocially for all of us. Like I could guarantee that, but we're very far away from that. Like we're still scaling in the gaming industry. We're starting to scale outside. And so I think for me personally, a lot of it is how do you unlock the product to get to that next level of scale where there's less friction to, because the thing is that's what revenue buys. Revenue buys that product team that can focus just on clinical cases.
Scalability, it's option.
It buys a lot. So like any CEO, I am focused on revenue. And so getting revenue up is the main thing that keeps me up at night. And, you know, other than that, just like personally, yeah, I think it's just staying on top of the things in your life that are still important. Like I'm skiing the Vasaloppet at the end of the month. It's a 90 kilometers, you know, Nordic ski race. 90K is a long way to go. So last night I was going to bed and I'm like, I got to drop 5 pounds because pounds.
Yeah, get cardio up.
Well, it's like, you know, 5 pounds if you ski 10K, it's fine. If you ski 90K, if you have another 5 pounds of weight on your back, like, so, you know, I think it's a combination of those two things. It's really one thing I think I've done having my clinical background is really making sure to double down on the, you know, they call it self-care in psychology, but it's what are the things that you need? And like for me, skiing is something I need. It's not something that's like a nice to have. It's something that I make time for it. It's scheduled into my day. I schedule other things around it. And that makes me, I think, a better founder, a better leader, a better partner, et cetera.
I absolutely love it. Let's bring it home here, Joe. What's the single greatest piece of advice you've ever received that you take action on daily? Could be a mantra, something you wake up first thing. I mean, I got mine, said it a million times. I'm not going to repeat it, but I'd love to hear yours.
I have a lot.
What's a go-to?
It really, like, I think mantras are just that. They're meant to be evoked for when you need them. And I think the one that I'm evoking right now, which is, it won't be probably in a year. It's that not everything is fixable and some things are conditions. And if you treat certain things as conditions, you can actually optimize for the overall system in a better way. So I think as founders, some people try to fix everything and it's not always the right thing to do.
Oh, that's a big one. And let's bring it home here. There's been a fascinating conversation and we could keep this going for a while, but my data shows that my listeners typically fall off around the 44 minute mark and we're at 46:10. So we're going to bring it home here and give the audience what they want. Last but not least, Joe, you look back on your life and I'm sure it wasn't all sunshines and rainbows and great pow days out there, right? But like there were those tough times when you had to dig down deep and figure shit out and harness that inner tenacity to pull you forward. And you sit here, appreciation, gratitude for this business that you've created and empowering so many individuals and companies. And I could sense that you're pretty much a happy guy there. What is your focus? What is your beacon? What is your North Star in life?
Oh man. I think the North Star in life for me is it's a deep peace and a deep knowing that like, I think it's just being capable. It's the combination of being really capable. Like I'm a wilderness first responder. I can help people. I can help myself. I have all these survival skills. So it's like, it's that baseline combined with a really strong vision for what actually could help make the world a better place. And I think when you have the baseline, because I think a lot of people, they don't have the bases covered. They don't know what's my mental health hygiene, what's my physical hygiene, they don't have their hygienes done. And then they go to try to help other people and they actually typically do more harm.
Yeah.
And so I think having that, and then I get to every day wake up and and the gifts that I was given and that I honed and that I created, we get to help companies bring play and adventure into digital experiences. So I'm doing exactly what, if you look back at my life, whether it was adventure therapy and play and UX and all these things, I'm doing the inevitability of those things. So Plant. I think really, really doubling down on who you are and not being afraid to go pursue that is what it's about.
That is what it's all about, folks. Joe, I want to thank you so much for joining me here. This has been a fascinating, incredible conversation. I want everyone to check out soulston.io. We're going to link it up there. Also connect with Joe on LinkedIn as well. Where else can folks find you? Where could they connect? Where could they learn more?
Soulston.io is fine. LinkedIn, joe@soulston.io is my email. Have a pop-up, but you know, happy to accept people. And if you want to just kind of get a wellness assessment, we did like a pro bono. It's wellbeing.soulston.io. It's like $1,000 psychological assessment that we did for free during COVID. It's anonymous. We don't track anything, but if you want to get a sense for, you know, your psychology, that's much better than a gimmicky thing. It's a pretty cool tool.
I dig it. And Joe, thank you. Hang with me for 1 second here. This is what it's all about, folks. If the show resonated with you, sharing means caring. Please spread the word. You know where to find out more at thepodcast.com. Leave a review, rating, engage. Hit me up in the DMs. I'll pass you over to Joe if you have any questions for him. Remember, look out for one another. Look out for one another. Be good to yourself. Be better to others. And catch us next week for another great episode of The Podcast. Take care, everybody.
Wisdom is forever. But for us, it's time to go. Thank you for joining us. Luckily, we'll be back with our next episode soon, jam-packed with more incredible humans. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and sharing. To join the conversation, search The Podcast on LinkedIn. And to catch up on past episodes and more info, please visit www.thepodcast.com.